morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I hope all you folks out there in KMUN Radio Land, our own North Pacific Ocean Coast Media Village community, are recovered from the trans-seasonal wooziness that accompanies clock time leap trauma. And today begins an annual cluster of loopy oddball days, oddly almanacked. For instance, today is Pi Day, 3.14, conjoining E equals MC squared day, Albert Einstein's 140th birthday today. Infinity accelerates the infinite. And tomorrow is Caesar Acupuncture Day, also known as the Ides of March, and the last day of KMUN's 36th annual spring pledge drive. So if you have been waiting to be a latter-day patron saint, the time is nigh. More about that in a few moments. The weekend is fittingly holidays of mythical patron saints of Finlandia and Hibernia, who committed equally mythical pesticide in their respective pre-medieval countries. The fabled Suomi Saint Urho and the Irish Saint Patrick, whose memorialization is equally Americana. Saturday, March 16th, is also the 51st anniversary of Mielai, an egregious example of real extermination. And if Monday might be considered among March memories, enforced racial displacement substitutes for legendary insect and reptile dispersion. On March 18, 1942, the U.S. War Relocation Authority was created to, quote, take all people of Japanese descent into custody, surround them with troops, prevent them from buying land, and return them to their former homes at the close of the war, unquote. That last promise was exploitedly broken. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt had issued Executive Order 9022-9022 the previous month to declare that all persons of Japanese ancestry, most of whom were American citizens, were to be removed from the West Coast, which included the states of California, Oregon, and Washington, as well as Arizona. The majority of nearly 130,000 Japanese Americans were forcibly removed from their homes to relocation camps inland in the spring of 1942. And as recently as last month, a bill has been introduced in Congress that would bar Americans from being forcibly incarcerated based on race or religion. But the racist ogre, Donald Trump, seems to think that it was correct to intern Japanese Americans, which should not surprise anyone given Trump's hateful rhetoric and inquisition against Muslims and immigrants whom he has quarantined in gulags. This trumped-up racial and religious hysteria speaks directly to the reason that free radio KMUN and all First Amendment media are absolutely necessary to counter the lawless, demagogic despotism increasingly rampant in our Yankee Doodle democracy. We are, as a democracy, being ruthlessly shanghaied into a corrupt dystopian instability in which the First Amendment is declared the enemy of the people, and the U.S. Constitution itself is relegated to partisan toilet paper. So to meet this spurious neo-fascist fake epiphany, we need all of the free speech and thought constitutionally communicated by First Amendment media, in particular public nonprofit broadcast and publication media, which is dependent on public rather than commercial support, which democratizes it at the base. What is public media? Former KMUN station manager Joe Vincentia addressed the question in the March 1995 issue of KMUN's monthly, The Current. We all know, each and every one of us, what public broadcasting is, he wrote. Or do we? Just like happiness, public broadcasting means different things to different people. Some turn on their radio and hear a liberal-based attack on American society and values, calling for the dismantlement of all we hold dear and true. While others can't stand to listen or watch because all they see or hear is an agent of propaganda for the corporate monsters with designs on breeding all the life and free will from each and every person in the land, which they are poisoning, by the way. We are anarchistic, provocatively reckless, dangerously passive. You name it, we have been called it. And that was Joe Vincentia. Harriet Baskus, KMUN's first station manager, as an introduction to the newborn media baby, said, KMUN, as a community radio station in the Pacific Northwest, shares with community radio stations worldwide the themes of democratization of communication, of wide community participation, and of creating an accessible forum for the exchange of cultural and political ideas. Quote, unquote. And that was Harriet Baskus. American society seems to undervalue most sorts of endeavors that do not make or do not seek to make a profit. The bottom line of American life is substantially the bottom line. From childhood, most of us are taught that money and its purchasing power are society's vitality and the only goals worth pursuit. Yet there are among the busy, self-interested hordes of cash-crazy capitalists a growing assemblance of persons who are dissatisfied with greed, avarice, and selfishness, who seek equitable, generous community, whose congenial aspirations seem disparate and heretical on the floor of the national stock market and are shoved aside in the diseased epidemic of wealth accumulation. KMUN reflects these lost and shouted down voices, a small public radio station at the bottom of the FM dial in a far-off corner of America, Incorporated. But it is here where community is free flow and free range, 91.9 Liberation Democracy. Controversy, original ideas, and experimental radio are anathema to commercial radio, which generally depends on insipidity to hype the unnecessary and indigestible, a gag gurgleplate of God, greed, and groovy. Until recently, the media wars were mostly about profit and essentially partisan politics, with bristly variations such as KMUN and its cousins. But now, hate-based ideology bleeds into the media stream with grim and virulent apocalyptic subordination of First Amendment intercourse to exclude diversity, intelligence, and honesty. Truth might not be the first casualty, but its destruction is the main target. Fact-based information is counterintuitively labeled fake news. And free-based communication is viciously attacked, as is the First Amendment itself, as an enemy of the people. The current media climate in the USA is loudly incendiary, with the mega-media and its octopedian meganopolies reflecting a schizoid, pandering to centrist anti-Trumpism with cable affiliates, while mainstreamingly placating extreme right-wing ideologues and religious zealots who blatantly manipulate media to void democracy and unhampered expression. So far, the only recognizable state media is the Fox News Network, though others that might be remain shadowy. Fortunately, Trump's initial attempt to fabricate a personal TV network, his own media brand of self-idolatry, so to speak, failed immediately. KMUN is obviously small fry radio, a literal micromorph underfoot rampaging rhinoceri. Yet the large consequences wash down to the least considered, and it is always useful to remember and possibly emulate the biblical David and his slingshot. ironically, despite absurd deceits by corporate mega media that it alone represents democracy and the First Amendment. A Lilliputian public radio station like KMUN depends upon true democracy to survive, and so it does because ordinary citizens keep it alive. So, pledge, pledge, pledge. Tomorrow's the deadline. So call 503-325-0010. Well, now I would like to read something that appeared in the New York Times, written by Liz Robbins and Sam Roberts. Early feminists issued a Declaration of Independence. Where is it now? And remember, this is Women's History Month. In 2015, the Obama White House put out a call to amateur historians to search their attics and archives for a relic of women's history. The original signed a copy of the Declaration of Sentiments and Resolutions from the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention in New York, one of the nation's first organized events for women's rights. Back then, about 300 people gathered for the two-day convention in upstate New York, and more than 100 women and men signed the manifesto, declaring it time for women to claim their rights in society. One, albeit low down on the list, was the right to vote. But unlike the Declaration of Independence, on which the Declaration of Sentiments was modeled, the original manuscript may no longer exist. The search yielded a few clues, but no manuscript with notes in the margin or signatures at the end. We found nothing except a couple of breadcrumbs, David Ferrario, the National Archivist of the United States, said. The Trump White House abandoned the project, which was started by Megan Smith, then the United States Chief Technological Officer under President Obama. But Ms. Smith, who is now Chief Executive of a digital tech company, Shift 7, plans to continue the search. We would like to find the original, she said, using the hashtag #FindTheSentiments, and give it the correct position of prominence it deserves with the charters of freedom in the rotunda of the National Archives, which are the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights. Absent an actual manuscript, the hunt has kicked up the dust of memory, resurrecting a document that laid in the groundwork for the women's suffrage movement. Next year, 2020, marks the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, the right of women to vote, which Congress passed on June 4th, 1919, 100 years ago this year. In this Me Too era, with women lawmakers appearing at the State of the Union on February 5th, wearing white in solidarity with suffrage, and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi battling with President Trump, the defiant declarations of long ago have never seemed so relevant. A campaign to find the original Declaration of Sentiments is not just a campaign to get the document. It's a campaign to raise public awareness of what those documents said and their place in history, says Donna Lieberman, director of the New York Civil Liberties Union. Our national history of inequality is something we have yet to succeed in getting rid of. We are still living with the long-term effects of inequality. That's true for women, for black people. You go back and read this, it just hits you over the head once again. And that was Donna Lieberman. The Founding Fathers had been warned. Remember the ladies, Abigail Adams wrote her husband and future president, John Adams, during the Revolutionary War, before the men went on to pin their Declaration of Independence and left out the ladies. The Declaration of Sentiments writes them back into history, mimicking the preamble with one addition. We hold these truths to be self-sufficient, that all men and women are created equal. It went on to accuse men of repeated injuries and usurpations, quote-unquote, against women, including including depriving them of having the right to vote, of equal wages, of access to professions like law and medicine, denying them marital property rights or the ease to divorce, and of restricting women's ability to attend the same universities as men. The last sentence in the Declaration accuses men of destroying women's confidence. Quote, "Woman is man's equal, and the highest good of the race demands that she should be recognized as such," the Declaration declares. Women's rights, let alone women's suffrage, was not exactly in vogue in 1848. Elizabeth Cady Stanton, frustrated in part by her domestic situation and inspired by her association with other female activists, had the idea for the Seneca Falls Convention. She and a handful of women drafted their ideas before hosting a two-day gathering in a Seneca Falls church. At the time, it was a revolutionary idea without much immediate impact, said Martha Saxton, a professor emeritus of women's history at Amherst College. "There were only about 7 people interested in women's suffrage at the time," she said. "It was not a popular issue." After a debate among the women at Seneca Falls, the right to vote ended up as number 9 on a list of 11 resolutions, the only resolution that was not unanimous. Number 9 said that it is the duty of the women of this country to secure to themselves their sacred right to the elective franchise. If you read Lucretia Mott, who said something about trembling at the idea, Ms. Saxton said, the women at Seneca Falls thought they would be ridiculed. They were right. Newspaper columns and church sermons responded with venom and disdain that foreshadowed the social media age. Editorials screamed headlines like "The Reign of the Petticoats" and "Insurrection Among the Women." The Mechanics Advocate called the convention unwomanly, the reforms unnecessary. In her book, 80 Years and More, Reminiscences, 1815 to 1897, Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote that she was shocked by the blowback. "No words could express what seemed to us so timely, so rational, and so sacred, should be a subject for sarcasm and ridicule to the entire press of the nation." And that was a quote from Stanton. But Seneca Falls did propel subsequent conventions for women's rights. And 3 years later, in 1851, Susan B. Anthony would join the growing suffrage movement. 2 weeks after Seneca Falls, Susan B. Anthony attended the Rochester Women's Rights Convention in Rochester, New York. And afterward, in September that year, forcefully reflected on the ridiculousness of being excluded. She said, or wrote, "To have the rights of drunkards, idiots, horse racing, rum-selling rowdies, ignorant foreigners, and silly boys recognized," Stanton wrote, "whilst we ourselves are thrust out from all rights that belong to citizens, it is too grossly insulting to the dignity of women to be longer quietly submitted to. The right is ours. Have it we must. Use it we will." And that was Stanton. Elizabeth Cady. While the Declaration of Sentiments was meant to be inclusive, no African American women were believed to have attended the convention at Seneca Falls. Scholars point to feminism's earlier influence, like the Anti-Slavery Convention of American Women of 1837 in New York City, where black, white, and Native American women attended. The role of black women in the feminist movement is a controversy still unfolding. The leaders of abolition and women's suffrage split into 2 rival women's groups, in part over who should have voting rights. Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony did not campaign for the 15th Amendment to the Constitution following the Civil War because it gave the right to vote first to African American women before all women. A scholar of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, N.D. Gordon, wrote a blog post in 2015 criticizing the search for the Declaration of Sentiments as a romantic quest by Megan Smith, and dismissed it as a hunt for a sacred document. In fact, other historians see Ms. Smith's public search as a chaotic quest because the content of the Declaration of Sentiments is widely available. Ms. Gordon, a research professor emeritus at Rutgers University, said that Ms. Smith treats the manuscript itself as a prize, that somehow if we don't have it handwritten with the signatures, that there is something less revealing about it, she says. She believes that the sought-after document never existed. Instead, the manuscript was more likely to be a collective of notes on several pages that were taken to the printing press of Frederick Douglass's North Star newspaper in Rochester, New York. The famous abolitionist Douglass, who attended the Seneca Falls Convention and signed the document, had the Declaration of Sentiments published as a pamphlet. Miss Gordon said that it was rare that originals came out of a print shop back then. But even if they were preserved by Douglass, who established his anti-slavery newspaper in 1847, they were most likely burned in the fire that destroyed Mr. Douglass's house in 1872, she said. Lisa Tetrault, a professor at Carnegie Mellon University, credited Ms. Gordon for her 40-year exhaustive search for all documents by Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. If it were to be found, she would have found it, Professor Tetrault said in an email. Archivists like Thomas Ruller from New York State defends the search for the Declaration of Sentiments manuscript. He says, "There is something special and unique about original documents handled by their creators, showing their edits and corrections." For Ms. Gordon, the renewed attention to a document that is lesser known in American history has served as a reminder of the never-ending fight for women's rights. Maybe what we learn is that this generation of women could think a whole lot of it through and lay down some rules, she says, about the women of Seneca Falls 171 years ago. And then we only later discovered how hard it would be to implement that. And that was an article written for and published in the New York Times by Liz Robbins and Sam Roberts. And now, speaking of equal rights, I'd like to read something I wrote. The Equal Rights Amendment, and the amendment in its totality. Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Quote, unquote. The pretense that half the human race is unequal and subordinate to the other half is a persistent malignancy. It has been chronic through history, especially in periods when muscle and force held sensitivity and intelligence in thrall. Yet the need to be equal and free is the most stubborn human hunger. It has taken centuries for women to emerge from the dominance of their male counterparts. It took almost a century for American women to gain the vote. So it should be no surprise that the Equal Rights Amendment to the Constitution will not stay dead. The ERA was last defeated on July 2, 1982, the date the nation's forefathers declared themselves free from England's tyranny and promised equality to all men. And that's a quote in 1776. The ERA failed, even though it had the support of 80% of the electorate, because of a handful of men in three state legislatures. Five other states which had initially approved the ERA rescinded their votes. Those who regard women as chattel celebrated and pronounced the ERA dead. The ERA has been sent to the grave more than once since Alice Paul wrote the amendment in 1923. On July 14, 1982, the same month as ERA's failure to be ratified on deadline, and the same day celebrated as the beginning of the French Revolution in 1789, 51 U.S. senators and 201 representatives co-sponsored the ERA in both houses of Congress. That attempt also failed. A national referendum would probably make the ERA law within a few months. Instead, when revived, and it will be, it must once more travel the torturously long trail through the states. 38 states must ratify it, and even the most optimistic believe it will take years. One possibility to encourage the process of making the ERA a part of the Constitution is for women to vote all who oppose it from office and support only candidates who endorse it. In the words of Susan B. Anthony, there shall never be another season of silence until women have the same rights men have on this green earth. This has been Michael McCusker. Pledge, pledge, pledge. Call 325-0010. 325-0010. Pledge, pledge, pledge.